The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas, presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutin, and our guest on The Breakfast Grill today is Dr. Farid Zakaria, the host of CNN's international affairs program, Farid Zakaria GPS. He's also a Washington Post columnist and a best-selling author with books like The Future of Freedom, The Post-American World, and In Defense of a Liberal Education. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. The recent World Capital Markets Symposium spoke to the question of global capitalism, but framed it within the notion of a renaissance. And it's a curious gesture, considering that there's been a lot of talk about the crisis of capitalism. Do you think thinking and using renaissance as an idea is useful when we look at the problems of global capitalism?
I do, actually, because what's unusual about this crisis is that unlike, say, the Great Depression or crises in the late 19th century, of which there were many crises of capitalism, they did not spawn a desire for a kind of wholesale rejection of capitalism. In this one, in fact, if you notice, the effect in many countries was to actually shift the political spectrum right. Now, that might be because of cultural issues, but Donald Trump is in power in the United States, a right-of-center candidate. Angela Merkel is running Germany, right-of-center candidate. Even Macron in France is not exactly left-wing. Why is that? Because I think it comes against the larger backdrop of the collapse of the Soviet Union, the discrediting of communism. Capitalism is the only game in town. So I think it makes sense to say we're not trying to destroy it, we're trying to reinvent it. And so Renaissance is appropriate.
You're, of course, well known for your views on international relations. Maybe you could help us understand what is the intersection between economic globalization and international relations?
Well, the most important intersection right now has been that economic globalization has resulted in what I call the rise of the rest, the rise of the non-Western world on a scale never seen before in 400 years. And so the rise of China, the rise of India, but not just of those countries, of Brazil, of Turkey, is all part of the story of economic globalization. And it is, as a result, fundamentally changing the geopolitics of the world. We are essentially entering a multipolar world. I call it a post-American world in my last book because I think we're leaving the stage of total American dominance. We have not yet found a new structure or framework. And so what we can all agree on is that America is no longer the sole dominant superpower in every area, but it hasn't been replaced by China and probably won't be. So what is this netherland we're in right now? It's post-American.
It's great that you mentioned the expression that I think you coined, the rise of the rest, especially in regard to your native land, the country you were born in. You left, I believe, in sort of the early 80s. Your father was a politician, I believe he was with the Congress Party, and your mother in journalism. The India that you left, the India today, much more ambitious, globalizing, but still, if you could speak to the question of Narendra Modi's paradox, man who looks outwards, but also who has sanctioned a really atavistic part of Indian politics, the rise of Hindu nationalism and fundamentalism.
Do you know, in some ways, it's not as much of a paradox, unfortunately, because this is what you're seeing around the world, which is leaders who have been able to find ways to manipulate nationalism, populism, or maybe not manipulate, employ nationalism and populism to further their ends. And they're often, they stride large on the world stage, Putin, Erdogan in Turkey, Modi in India, and to a certain extent, Trump is a version of the same forces. And what they all have in common is this ability to find a way to use nationalism to consolidate power domestically by focusing on some other. You know, in the case of Trump, it's the Mexicans and the Chinese and Muslims. In the case of Putin, it's the West. In the case of Erdogan, also it's the West. For Modi, you're right. He has found a way to very subtly, and in some times not so subtly, play on the old Hindu-Muslim divide in India while still presenting himself very much as a modernizer. It is the formula for political success these days. It's a sort of call it modern nationalism or something.
Well, what about the question of India's institutions? I'm just speaking as somebody who maybe observes India more closely. Its democratic institutions, its judiciary, I mean, quite different from a Russia, I guess, in that regard. Do you think Indian society and political society will be able to resist the temptations of going down this rather dark road that some observers note?
You know, I think it will. But I think the part of the tragedy of what the moment we're in is there are a great many illiberal things, the things that are contrary to liberalism, constitutionalism in spirit. A great many of these things can be done quite legally. You know, a lot of the things that are being done to divide Indians one from the other, there's nothing illegal about them. It's just bad. You know, it's just not the kind of leadership one would look for. A lot of the attacks on media, for example, that are done very much like Donald Trump. Modi, you know, takes a page from that same playbook. A lot of it is quite legal. It's just discrediting established media, creating, you know, a suspicion that fact is not fact and everybody has their own narrative. In some cases, it's strong-arming the media through the withdrawal of government advertising, through, you know, harassment that's done through tax cases and things. So, you know, is it illegal? No, I mean, that's the trap. What I'm noticing is that it is possible to undermine democracy without violating democratic institutions. You can violate democratic norms. You can change the leadership culture. And you do a lot of damage. I think that, you know, a lot of us may have thought that democracy is just all about the rule of law and constitutions and such. But a lot of it is informal. You know, there was an unwritten practice that American presidential candidates released their tax returns. And then one day Donald Trump said, well, I'm not going to do it. And what I worry about is not just that Trump didn't do it. Well, what if the next guy comes around and says, well, I don't have to do it. There's no such tradition anymore. Trump didn't do it. You know what I mean? And such. And so the standard becomes a non-standard.
Both the U.S. and India, in some sense, children of Enlightenment values. They have instilled that in their institutions and their culture to some extent. The opposite pole would be China. What do you think a small country, middling-sized economy, and middling-sized political power like Malaysia can do must consider when negotiating this new landscape?
So I think the most important thing for Malaysia to understand is it cannot be China. China, first of all, it's sort of unique for a whole variety of different reasons, but it will never be a real role model for another country because its size and its scale mean that it can do things that nobody else can do. For a country like Malaysia, a much better role model, I mean, I know Malaysians are not going to want to hear this, but is Singapore, which is to say, when you're small, emphasize good governance, emphasize rule of law, emphasize transparency, emphasize the way in which you can be receptive to foreign capital, foreign goods, foreign ideas, because that's your only chance. When you're China and you have 1.3 billion people and you have this vast internal market, you can have your own strange system that is, you know, market Leninism, I think somebody once called it, where you have Leninist political structures and yet some kind of free market. Malaysia doesn't have that option. Malaysia has to be outward-oriented, and it has to have good governance.
I mean, if you watch the tensions in the South China Sea, there was a lot of talk initially of that, you know, stepping up or escalating into some sort of armed conflict. What do you think is the reality in the ground, coming from an American's perspective, about the rise of China, about the former security architecture that America presided over? Is that done? Are we looking at a changeover? Will China be the new reality for Malaysia?
I think that one of the most unfortunate elements of Trump's administration has been the kind of withdrawal or inattention being paid to Asia. I know that many Asians thought Obama talked about a pivot to Asia but wasn't able to completely consolidate it or to give substance to it, partly because the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was meant to be the centerpiece, fell a prey to kind of political tensions in the United States over trade. But here's the fundamental reality. China is not so far behaving as a rapacious regional power. It is the second largest economy in the world. Of course, it's going to want to have a greater political, it's one going to want to have greater political influence in its backyard, in its region. That's natural. It's understandable. But there have to be limits and there has to be pushback. There has to be the ability for other small independent countries to ensure that they don't get rolled over. That is where the essential role that the United States was playing, and I think, I hope will continue to play, is to give backbone to these smaller countries. Some of them can be bought off, like the Philippines. But I think that in the long run, what the United States, the best role the United States can play is to ensure that Asia remains a place that no one country dominates, which has a kind of plurality of power. And I actually am pretty hopeful that that will happen because, as I say, I don't think China is another Germany or Japan in the early 20th century. And I think that the big reality is China is rising in an Asia that is also rising. You know, people often talk about the rise of Asia, but there is no Asia, actually. There are various countries within Asia, China, India, Japan. They don't like each other. And so China's rise produces an almost automatic counterbalance from India and from Japan, to a certain extent from Australia and Vietnam. So that is the dynamic. That's why China will never be able to be the kind of unrivaled superpower that the United States was. The United States rose in the Western Hemisphere, surrounded by two vast oceans and two weak neighbors. China is rising in Asia, a cockpit of regional power, tension, aspirations, border disputes. So it knows it needs to proceed carefully. I believe it will proceed carefully. And the only thing I think is important for others to do is to ensure that it rises peacefully by keeping in place some checks and balances.
One last question. You're a journalist and you're based in the U.S. There are many conversations that are American but become globalized, everything from hashtag MeToo to the question of migration. What conversation do you think, as Malaysians, we should be attentive to that are happening within the borders of America but are, in fact, of a universal import?
Well, I think it's the things you've been asking about, which is the quality of democratic governance, I think, is the big challenge we face. We all have the forms. And I think we, maybe in the United States, believed that our forms were the best and our practices were the best. This is plainly untrue. I think we can all learn from each other, but we can also all learn from the violations, as I say, some of them very subtle, that are taking place. The way in which Trump is able to discredit the mainstream media by casting doubt on the very idea of fact and truth. This is, to my mind, one of the most pernicious attacks really on the Enlightenment, on the idea of evidence-based policy. I think that's going to spread, unfortunately, and I think that the new technologies make it more and more possible to essentially construct fantasy and present it as fact, to take digitally altered people and to place them in situations they never were in. There was this video of a New York senator who's put in a sex video. Turns out, of course, it's completely fake. It's doctored, but it looks very authentic. And then afterwards, you poll people and you ask them, what do you think of that senator? And about a third of them say, oh, wasn't she involved with some kind of pornography? So you see, you've planted the doubt. You've planted the idea. This is, I think, the new challenge we in democracies face, which is all these soft ways that are, I suppose, mostly perfectly legal to undermine democracy itself. You use democracy to undermine democracy.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
I've been speaking to Dr. Farid Zakaria, the host of CNN's International Affairs program, Farid Zakaria GPS, and a columnist with the Washington Post. He was at the World Capital Markets Symposium, brought to you by the Securities Commission, Malaysia. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.